Today is Thursday, September the 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says that the Taliban are blocking charter flights containing Americans from departing Afghanistan.
Let me be very clear. Those flights need to be able to leave. And the United States government, the State Department, we are doing everything we can to help make that happen.
The pandemic and other restrictions do not stop Moroccan voters as they turn out in record numbers to cast ballots for their legislators and local leaders.
So people were invited to vote on those three elections all at once, because historically participation for parliamentary elections was lower than regional and municipal.
And UN human rights experts say that the international community is abandoning millions of Yemeni civilians to a life of suffering and desperation as the country enters its seventh year of civil war. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is calling on the Taliban to allow charter flights carrying Americans and at-risk Afghans to depart from Afghanistan. Planes chartered to carry people out of the country have been stuck at Mazar-e al-Sharif International Airport. Speaking at a press conference Wednesday at the Ramstein Air Base in Germany, Blinken said that the U.S. government had made clear to the Taliban that those chartered flights need to be able to depart.
As I think all of you know, a number of groups and individuals determined to help are working to organize charter flights out of Afghanistan, including from Mazar-e Sharif, for people who wish to depart. We're grateful for those efforts. There's been a fair amount of confusion surrounding the flights, and let me just clarify a few things. As of now, the Taliban are not permitting the charter flights to depart. They claim that some of the passengers do not have the required documentation. While there are limits to what we can do without personnel on the ground, without an airport, with normal security and procedures in place, we are working to do everything in our power to support those flights and to get them off the ground. That's what we've done. That's what we will continue to do. Specifically, we're working with NGOs, with advocates, with lawmakers around the clock to help coordinate their efforts and offer guidance where we can. We're helping to arrange landing rights and liaise with other countries in the region in the question of overflight. We've made clear to all parties, we've made clear to the Taliban, that these charters need to be able to depart, and we continue every day, virtually every hour, to work on that. As you know, this is also a complex situation.
Reacting to news on the formation of the new interim government in Afghanistan, Blinken says that any legitimacy or international support for the Taliban would have to be earned.
Yesterday, the Taliban named a new interim government. We're assessing the announcement, but despite professing that a new government would be inclusive, the announced list of names consists exclusively of individuals who are members of the Taliban or their close associates, and no women. We're also concerned by the affiliations and track records of some of those individuals. We understand the Taliban has presented this as a caretaker cabinet. We will judge it and them by its actions.
That was U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. At a news conference, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says that the U.S. and others are watching the Taliban's actions.
It's whether they let people depart the country who want to depart, whether they treat women across the country as they have committed to treat them, and how they behave and operate. And therefore, we're not moving toward recognition. At the same time, we're dealing with a reality world here where we have to engage in order to get American citizens and others out of the country.
That was White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. And records from Johns Hopkins University show that the number of COVID-19 patients in hospitals across the U.S. this Labor Day weekend was nearly 300% higher than this time last year, with the average number of deaths over 86% higher than the same period of last year. Analysts say that what was supposed to be the summer of hope against the coronavirus is ending in gloom. Associated Press reporter Ed Donahue has the story.
More than 26,000 deaths were reported last month, more than 4 million infections. It's the fourth highest total since the start of the pandemic. Overall, more than 650,000 people have died, and a major forecast model projects 750,000 deaths by December 1st. Hopes were high, but the Delta variant, along with resistance to vaccinations, dashed those hopes. This outbreak is still well below the all-time peaks over the winter. Cases in most states appear to be plateauing and are likely to decline in the fall, buying more time to vaccinate adults and teenagers before flu season. Ed Donahue, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Millions of Moroccans went to the polls on Wednesday in municipal and regional elections. The government said that turnout was just over 50% higher than previous elections in 2016, a factor that many attribute to the decision by authorities to combine both parliamentary and local elections. This year's local elections were held under new rules and restrictions that analysts say was expected to make it harder for the Islamist PJD to remain as the biggest party in the country. Hannah Bezad is a reporter based in Rabat. She joins me via phone on her way back from casting her ballot.
So today in Morocco, three elections were held, municipal, regional, and parliamentary elections. So people were invited to vote on those three elections all at once because historically, participation for parliamentary elections was lower than regional and municipal. And there was a lot at stake to make sure that more Moroccan people would actually vote because the government and the head of the government is decided based on the number of seats parties get at the parliament.
Okay, and how was the turnout this time around? How was it affected by the pandemic?
So it's, to be honest, it's very surprising and positively surprising because at this point it's 10:40 and they've only released the information about 40 minutes ago. But it seems like the level of participation is at 50.18%.
Is that better than previous elections? How does that compare
yes,
to previous ones?
It is better than previous elections, but one needs to say that the rules have changed substantially. Basically, the changes are that seats are now granted based on the number of registered voters rather than the number of those who actually cast the ballot. Okay. And the reason for this change in the process is because it is believed that it's meant to be reducing the level of influence of the Islamist party that has been in power for the last 10 years, basically, the PJD, Parti de la Justice et du Développement.
Okay, and how long was the campaign period?
So the campaign was limited to 15 days. So only the last week of August were parties were allowed to campaign openly. And that, of course, limits the extent of the democratization process that is meant to be sustaining, I mean, these momentums of democratic expression. It's probably linked to the pandemic, but it's also linked to many other strategies at this point.
Okay. And speaking to, you know, what were you hearing about? What are some of the motivations, issues motivating people to turn up to vote this time around?
I mean, historically, Moroccans have been very reluctant to vote in general. And I mean, you know, Morocco has been avoiding and masterfully killing the efforts of some collectives back in 2011 when in other countries in the Arab world, there were uprisings. And so they changed the constitution, and that's how basically the regime became more of a parliamentary monarchy, but eventually turned out to be at the advantage of the Islamist party, and they have been leading the government for the past 10 years. And I believe, I mean, in general, there were 30 plus parties that were competing. So it's a lot. I believe in 15 days is absolutely, it makes it very hard for average citizens to dedicate this time to compare programs, understand fully the strategy of this or that list, and vote in full awareness. But again, I'm also happy with the fact that we're looking at distributing a bit more power. And quite frankly, I'm also happy that we're expecting the Islamist Party to lose a little bit its influence. I think it's been hindering the progress of the country. Voice of
America. The United States marks the 20th anniversary this week of the 9/11 attacks on the country. Longtime journalist Adam Phillips was part of the team of VOA reporters, editors, and engineers covering the attacks and their aftermath. Phillips, who recently retired after 28 years with VOA, spent time recalling the work he did, bringing the story to the world. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson recently about his work in those days.
Well, the very first day, I was just driving in my car down to VOA, which, as you know, is like at the heart of the nation's capital. And I remember hearing that there was a plane that had hit the World Trade Center on National Public Radio, and then another plane hit. And I remember going into my editor's office as that moment happened, and we all went, oh my gosh, this is intentional. This is a terrorist attack. I was immediately sent to the White House, which was being evacuated. And then I was sent to the Pentagon, which is the seat of our military, which was also hit by a plane. And I just remember the rows and rows and rows of ambulances waiting to get in while the inferno raged on within the military building. Manhattan Island itself was closed to anybody. Nobody can get off the island or on the island. There were ferry boats going from Manhattan to people's homes in New Jersey, et cetera, but there were no trains in. There was no public transportation until the very next morning. And I made darn sure that I was that I was on that train. I just started asking questions and I tried to keep my heart open and see what was going on for people, because it's the impact of what happened on them. That was my brief. That was what they wanted me to talk about.
Now, you are primarily a feature reporter, telling stories about human life and human emotion, not necessarily the sort of breaking news reporters where you're standing up saying, oh, the president has just said this. How did you go about your work then in New York?
Yeah, you're right. For me, as a features reporter, also called a background reporter, because it's not always fluffy, the idea is that the news that happens, what the president says or the planes hit, that just gets you in the game. That's just the occasion for finding out from people what they're feeling, what they're thinking about, what's going to happen next, if that's what their concern is, and all the emotions that were going on that day, including lots of shock and grief. But I just rented a hotel room on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and a couple blocks away, I was near Lincoln Center, and the whole plaza there had turned into a place for recruiting volunteers for the Red Cross and all kinds of other stuff. There was civilians really, really self-mobilized, and also, you know, joined NGOs and other groups to see anything they could do to comfort people, to look for somebody, to type a letter for somebody, to make photocopies of missing posters. So I went there and I just asked them what they were doing and why they wanted to volunteer and how they felt about this moment. You can imagine how much material was on the ground smoldering there from those huge, huge, huge buildings. And so it fell to some people to go to what they call the pile, and to go in there with trucks and put all that smoldering stuff, that totally unbelievably toxic, horrible stuff, onto trucks and then bring it to the barges and send it down to Freshkills, this place in New Jersey. And so I spent a lot of time there and interviewing some of these guys. I'm sure most of them are dead now, who just went back and forth and back and forth. And it was a spiritual experience for a lot of them. I mean, they were angry and they just really felt it was their job to do it. Another thing I did was I went to a town called Middletown, New Jersey, which was a beautiful little bedroom, I guess, small city in New Jersey where a lot of workers in the World Trade Center lived. And I went there to just talk to the characters who were there about about what it's like for this town to go through this grief. So I spoke to somebody whose husband was still missing. I spoke to a detective whose sorry job it was to knock on doors and say, look, we found the remains to your wife. And the police chief, you know, who started crying. And it became sort of a portrait of grief writ large. Again, it's not news, but it's something that wouldn't have happened without the news. It was tied to the news. And so that's the kind of stuff I was doing.
That was former VOA journalist Adam Phillips speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson. Twenty people linked to the November 2015 terrorist attacks in France went on trial in Paris Wednesday in proceedings expected to last 9 months. Six defendants are being charged in absentia. Reports say five of the six are presumed dead in Iraq or in Syria. And rebel forces in Ethiopia's Tigray region denied reports that they had killed dozens of civilians over a two-day period in the Amhara area. The Reuters news agency reported Wednesday that regional authorities said 120 civilians were killed between September 1st and 2nd. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. UN human rights experts say the international community is abandoning millions of Yemeni civilians to a life of intolerable suffering and desperation as Yemen enters its seventh year of civil war with no end in sight. The statement comes as the three-member UN group of eminent international and regional experts on Yemen presents its findings ahead of a report to the UN Human Rights Council next week. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations estimates more than 1,200 civilians have been killed or injured in Yemen this year. This is on top of the more than 20,000 civilians who have been killed or injured since the war began in 2015. Additionally, the UN Humanitarian Office reports about 233,000 people have died of causes related to hunger, disease, lack of health care, a collapsed economy, and other indirect causes. Eminent expert Ardi Imsels says civilians continue to pay the highest price in this conflict as they sink deeper into hunger, poverty, suffering, and despair.
This year, the group of eminent experts continues to have reasonable grounds to believe that all parties to the conflict have committed serious violations of international human rights and humanitarian law, some of which may amount to war crimes. As we have said before, there are no clean hands in this conflict.
The group accuses the government of Yemen, supported by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and Iranian-backed Houthi rebels of multiple atrocities. The report documents numerous airstrikes in populated areas by the Saudi-led coalition and indiscriminate shelling attacks by the Houthis. The range of violations committed by all parties include arbitrary detention, enforced disappearances, torture, rape, and other forms of gender-based sexual violence. In view of the enormous suffering of the Yemeni people, eminent expert Melissa Park says the situation in Yemen should be at the top of the international agenda.
We're seeing with children, a generation of children caused irreparable harm, forced to be child soldiers, denied their fundamental rights to food and education, to health care. Yemen was already patriarchal before the war, but the situation for women has only become worse with the conflict and the associated displacement, extreme poverty, and indiscriminate violence.
The group says impunity for these crimes must end. Perpetrators must be held accountable and brought to justice. The eminent experts are calling on states to stop all arms transfers to the parties, which they say are driving the conflict. The report contains a so-called non-exhaustive list of countries that are providing weapons to Yemen's warring parties. They include Canada, France, Iran, Britain, and the United States. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Turkey is voicing caution over Afghanistan's interim government as it continues talks with the Taliban on restarting air traffic at the Kabul airport. For VOA from Istanbul, Dorian Jones reports on the delicate diplomatic balancing act Turkey is performing with the Taliban.
Turkey was among the first countries calling for talks and engagement with the Taliban after it swept to power last month. But the Taliban's announcement of an interim government this week saw Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan calling for a cautious approach. As you know, right now it's hard to call it permanent, but an interim cabinet has been announced, Erdogan said Tuesday. He said, "We don't know how long this interim cabinet will last. All we have to do is to follow this process carefully." But Erdogan said talks between the Taliban and Qatar on restarting full operations at the Kabul airport were making progress, although he warned key issues remained unresolved. On Monday, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu said the Taliban's insistence on being the one to provide the airport security remains a key obstacle.
Birçok ülke büyükelçiliğini buradan geri çekerken,
Cavusoglu said the Taliban or Afghan forces could ensure security outside the airport, but inside, he said, there should be a security company trusted by the international community. He added that otherwise, even if airlines, including Turkish Airlines, are keen to fly there, insurance companies would not allow it. Despite Turkey's participation in NATO's 20-year-long military presence in Afghanistan, the Taliban reached out to Ankara with calls to put the airport back into operation. Turkey is NATO's only Muslim member, and it shares historical ties with Afghanistan. Asla Aydintashbash, a senior fellow at the European Council, says Ankara believes these factors could help Turkey play a key role in Afghanistan.
They'll want to see if they can position Turkey as a diplomatic conduit, as a diplomatic sort of a go-between between Western countries and the Taliban.
The reopening of the Kabul airport is key for European countries and the United States in efforts to evacuate their citizens who are still in Afghanistan, as well as Afghan nationals who once worked for NATO and Western embassies. After meeting his Turkish counterpart, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas underlined Turkey's importance in efforts to reopen the airport, offering to help finance the operation. But retired Turkish ambassador Selim Kunaalp says Ankara must deal delicately with the Taliban.
It seems to me that there would be a risk in appearing to be too close to the Taliban, to appear as their protectors, so to speak, in the eyes of the West, not just the United States, but the European Union too, because if you appear to be very close to them, then you're painted with the same brush.
Ankara's cautious approach to the new Afghan government and Turkish calls for scrutiny of the Taliban's treatment of women and ethnic minorities could be signs of a growing awareness of Turkey's need to remain aligned with its Western allies over Afghanistan. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
In Malawi, authorities fear that vaccine hesitancy could lead to tens of thousands of COVID-19 vaccines expiring early next month. With just 2% of Malawi's population vaccinated, authorities hope to increase uptake by deploying mobile vaccination clinics to bring the vaccine closer to people. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi has so far received just over 1.2 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines under the COVAX facility. But vaccine hesitancy in Malawi is widespread just because of misperceptions of the jab's efficacy and safety. Dr. Gift Kawalazira, who heads the Health and Social Services at the Blantyre Health Office, says there is another reason for the low vaccination rate.
So we have noticed that with the coming in of summer, the number of cases have drastically reduced, and also the number of people coming for vaccinations have reduced from having over 2,000 people per day to having just about 400 people per day now.
Dr. Kawalazira said deploying mobile vaccination centers will help increase vaccine uptake, noting that when the initiative was launched Saturday, over 600 people were vaccinated and six companies booked the mobile clinic to come and vaccinate their workers. He predicts the initiative will help Malawi meet its vaccination target by 60% by 2022 and allay fears that more vaccines will expire.
Johnson & Johnson is actually expiring after December, but AstraZeneca have got two different batches. One of it is expiring next month, and the other one is going up until December.
In May, Malawi incinerated about 20,000 AstraZeneca doses that had expired after many people refused the jab due to concerns about its safety and efficacy. Malawi Health Ministry statistics show that currently only about 700,000 people have had one jab, while about 400,000 are fully vaccinated, representing 2.1% of the 18 million population. Simeon Piri got his jab Wednesday at a mobile COVID-19 vaccination clinic at Limbe Market in Blanta. He told VOA that this has helped me a lot because it has provided me easy access to the vaccine instead of walking a long distance. I came here to Limbe to do some errands, but I also have found an opportunity to get vaccinated. To increase uptake in rural areas, the government is currently working with traditional leaders to mobilize and tell their communities about the need to be vaccinated when the mobile clinics visit their villages. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Somalia's president and prime minister appear locked in a power struggle over the country's spy chief and the death of a cybersecurity agent. Prime Minister Mohamed Hossein Roubo this week suspended the head of the National Intelligence and Security Agency, Fahad Fassin, for failing to investigate the agent's death. But the president rebuked the move and on Wednesday appointed Yassin as a national security advisor. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo reshuffled top positions in the security sector Wednesday, appointing suspended spy director Fahad Yassin as his national security advisor, while installing former Benadu Regional Intelligence Chief Colonel Yassin Abdullahi as acting director of the National Intelligence and Security Agency, NISA. Troubler described the president's move as an obstruction of justice toward the investigation of alleged death of a young female spy, Ikram Tahlil Farah. Farah disappeared in June and was declared dead by NISA this month, though the spy agency has yet to disclose any details about her passing. Political analyst Hassan Modane says the bitter exchange between the office of the president and his prime minister could weaken cooperation between the federal government institutions. He says various institutions, such as the judiciary, presidency, security departments mainly in the capital Mogadishu, as well as the fight against the armed group Al-Shabaab, will be affected by the wrangles. He added that the election process, coordinated by the office of the prime minister, will also be tested. The elections for 19 remaining seats in the upper house of parliament and 275 members of the lower house are expected to kick off shortly in Somalia's slow-moving election process. But according to security analyst Samira Ahmed of Hiral Institute, the tiff between two top leaders will make the work of the Somali security agencies and their international partners very hard. She said the prime minister was tasked to spearhead the election process, which was in good shape so far, but this latest difference between his office and that of the president may impact on the security and damage the credibility and confidence in the election process. She added that, in terms of perception, it also damages the legitimacy of the state-building process in the eyes of the Somali people and their international partners as well. In a joint press statement, the leaders of the opposition, who are also presidential candidates, threw their weight behind Prime Minister while timing the actions of the president as derailing the ongoing election process. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day ahead.